I love Montana. I love everything about Montana. I like the people. I have a couple of houses here. I vacation in Montana, so what a welcome. And now I see why I really want to be here, which is the people who are here trying to make the world a better place. I've worked with Max, you know, Senator Baucus, for many, many years. There is no finer public servant than your senator. What can I say? So, you know, speaking here in, to be honest, what I really want to do is talk about economics. And to be honest, I'm concerned that economists are going to, they're going to need to invent a new politics, a new doctrine, right? The logic of politics and government are colliding with the efficiency of globalized technology and distribution networks. And we thought they're disrupting everything that we thought about growing local economies, right? By the way, Montana economy seems to be beating the national averages. Congratulations. Statewide unemployment is less than 6%. Real wage growth is pretty strong across the state. But Montana, like everywhere else, has to compete in the global market. And the global economics trends that we see portend dramatic changes ahead. The analysis you get in reading current economics is very pessimistic. And even worse, politicians seem to lack coherent plans to fix these. So let me give you some examples. Unemployment, especially youth unemployment, is intractable in mature democracies. In Europe, youth unemployment is 23%, and in some countries, Spain is 50%, Greece is 65%. And not much else seems to be working. Now, in the U.S., things are somewhat better, but still bad. Less than 60% of Americans now have a job, and youth unemployment is at 16%. You only have to look at Japan, right, to see what happens in a society when youth unemployment becomes the norm. You have a lost generation. And second, globalization is leading to a hollowing out of stable middle-class jobs, certainly in the U.S. and in Europe. While high and low-skill jobs are doing fine, right, the jobs in the middle skill range, which a lot of our citizens here are in, have fallen over the last 15 years due to globalization. Manufacturing jobs, once a driver of U.S. economy, have shifted overseas to lower wage things, and on and on and on. You know all of this. So I've got a couple of examples of sort of new models of work. Odesk and Elance are online employers, right? So they're interesting. People are flocking to them. They claim to employ over 4 million coders, web designers, marketing professionals, and other workers between them. Odesk says that their contractors worked 8.5 million hours. The average freelancer at Elance expects to make 43% more money in 2013. So people are moving online, but the jobs are not necessarily being created to replace the old job. There's another problem, right? Sorry to sort of start with all the problems, but I think let's just get it out there, with demographic changes. Lower unemployment, fewer people will be supporting more people, right? The census pop clock shows the bulge of baby boomers approaching their 60s and 70s. In Europe, aging is so well known that it has its own Wikipedia page, Europe Getting Older, right? The IMF projects that in 2013, the ratio of workers to retired people will have to shrink by half so that only two workers support one retiree. More than one in five Japanese are over the age of 65, and that'll soon become one in four, right? So when China, of course, makes it completely worse with this one disastrous one-child policy. Another problem we're seeing is a new trend for companies to invest in capital ahead of people, right, for the right reasons in many cases. In a recent book, the people argued that historically when companies' profits have grown, they've earned their profits and then they have reinvested those profits in capital and workers, and they've hired people. But following the recession in 2007 and 2008, unemployment has remained stubbornly high, 9% as you know, and we're not showing a lot of progress in addressing it. So worse, the unemployment are staying unemployed longer, right? Also not good. So investment in capital, however, right, the money for infrastructure and machines and so forth, has bounced back to 95% of its historic high. So capital before people, not necessarily the best choice for our society. And then there's another potential, which is even more bizarre, but I should point it out, that there's a potential for us to make governments more efficient. Right? We're all working, and my company is certainly trying to do this, and try to make their productivity better in the same sense as you saw in the private sector. But if you make the public sector more productive, perhaps you will be employing fewer people and certainly will create fewer new jobs. So you have this perverse problem of private sector jobs not creating and public sector becoming more efficient. Not good. So before we sort of sink into this sort of despicable, terrible state, right, there is actually an alternative model. I say what I said because these are the economic facts and this is what you see on television. But I would suggest that there's a different way of looking at this, which is to take the view of an optimist. What's going on in my world? Completely new ways of thinking about artificial intelligence. Latency, the speed with which things are occurring, occurs much faster. We're rethinking transportation with self-driving cars. If you're spending time in cities that are very crowded, think New York or LA or whatever, look around you. The streets are incredibly clogged. The airspace is pretty empty. So again, new modes of transportation, personal transportation in the air, and things like this. But most importantly, we're busy making you smarter, that your IQ literally goes up, because the tools and the techniques that Google and other companies are providing, they just make you a smarter, better worker, better, obviously your entertainment is better, you're a better educator, and so forth and so on. So that's an optimistic view. So how do we square these two views together? Well, I think that the future of work is in fact going to be great for humans. It's not going to be bad. And I think that it starts with innovation. That's what this conference is about. It's flourishing, right? And technological innovation, invention in particular, has driven almost all human progress and tremendous economic growth over the centuries. Right? If you look back over history between 5000 BC and 1800, world GDP per capita about doubled over 2,000 years. That would be the definition of low growth, right? Nothing ever changed except you were in a war, right? But in the last 200 years, with the start of the Industrial Revolution, per capita GDP has gone up by a factor of 33. Now, you often, and by the way, if anybody wants to go back to 200 years ago, just think dentistry, right? Just think about it. Now, people are always saying, oh, you know, it's different today, and so forth and so on. The technology is reducing the need for human unemployment, but that's not just borne out by the facts. Over the course of this last day, you've had a chance to hear from shining examples, right, of what a friend of mine, Hal Varian, calls micro-multinationals right here in Montana. Right? In fact, I just met with a whole bunch. These are people who are based in Montana who think that their market is the globe. They didn't even start with the country. Right? This is exactly the kind of thinking that I want to see. And these successes, you don't have to be just a city or a state. You don't need to be a tech hub. You can actually use the technology where you are, right? With a combination of broadband, which you all need to improve, especially for rural areas, especially for people who are sort of far from the cities here in Montana. But even small companies in remote parts of the web are using the web to grow. I mean, that's how profound this is. And as these small micronationals grow, they raise local demand in Montana for other jobs, right? So there's an Italian economist whose name is Enrico Moretti, who's found that for each high-tech job, 5 additional jobs are created outside the high-tech center in the city or the town, both in skilled occupation, these are lawyers and teachers, nurses, but also unskilled ones, you know, waiters, hairdressers, what have you. And second, technology will continue not just to create more jobs, but better jobs. Imagine a 19th century worker or even an early 20th century office worker walking into the office of a Silicon Valley office today. They didn't do any of the instant access to communication, they didn't use computers, and so forth, the writing of code. It's always hard for us to imagine the big changes that will come because of the infrastructure that we're building here, right? Because our minds are linear, you know, we sort of extrapolate from what we've seen. But the history in my industry, and I think in others that are disruptive, is literally it changes everything, right? When was the last time you didn't take your cell phone to a meeting? 1990, because that's when they were invented, right? You forget you were alive then. Okay, you get the idea. But there's no reason to suppose that what we describe as work today will be the primary work form of work tomorrow. The changes that we're seeing now are really about the rise of network power and the rise of computing. Network intelligence brings many, many things. And computers get much, much better at answering general questions. We say general task intelligence increases alongside task-specific intelligence, how we describe it. So this notion of smart computers can seem sexy because we think of computing as creating a reduction of labor. And sometimes, of course, it does. But more often, it's a collaboration of labor, right? You and the computer doing something together, you being more productive. Whenever you talk about economics, it's sort of a rule that you have to quote Adam Smith. So the title of The Wealth of Nations, third chapter, is that the division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. Adam Smith was talking about specialization in jobs. That the core issue, he's still right, that the core issue of globalization is there's no other planet that we can go conquer, right? We can't go create the job somewhere else and move the unemployed to that planet. We've got to build the current model and make it into this new model, or the current model of specialization will in fact fail because the pessimists will be proven right. And the current model will produce lagging returns. Now, so computers accelerate the development of these specialized skills, right? The sort of the creativity that you're describing, to the point that future computers might be able to help a person better explain our best talent, right? And future networks may have as members the people who have that talent. In other words, detection of talent becomes a computing problem. The computer can say, these people really are better. Go hire them now. Get them to Montana. We need them here. And we'll still need people in lots of other ways. Planes will still need pilots for all sorts of good reason. But airplanes are safer because of the computers that are in them. The elderly still need caretakers, right? Those carers are just much more effective because the automation and monitoring and equipment that they use. Computers helping us optimize our skill sets so that we can retrain and get better jobs. And I think this is incredibly important. Technology and innovation can help reverse the decades of ever longer and harder work that's placing such a strain on families and, in particular, young moms today. So when I look at this, I say that the knowledge economy has led to longer work hours in much of the developed world, and some say has reduced human-to-human connectedness by putting us in front of screens rather than other people. My prediction is that the knowledge economy is likely to be replaced by a much more nuanced version of human-centric, creative, and caring economies. That this collaboration between us and computers is going to produce new work, especially right here. Now, there's a lot of data that suggests that this existing creative economy has adapted quite successfully to the first phase of digitization. Yes, it's been hard, but they have adapted, right? So there's been growth in the production and revenue, right, of music, video film, books, video games in the U.S., France, Germany, Italy, Russia, Spain, and the U.K. So even through a decade of economic and technological turmoil, the entertainment industry grew 50%. Good for them. And it was tough. It was absolutely tough as consumers increased spending on entertainment. Good for everybody. We've only begun to imagine the ways in which technology can monetize creative efforts, not to mention the market for consuming the output. The art world, for example, went from making one print to making 10 prints, right? They sign each one of them, right? So the author gets 10 times as much money. So technology will ultimately, for example, allow you to price a live stream event different from an event that you attend. And other limited edition kinds of viewings. Kickstarter is an interesting company. Kickstarter and something called Indiegogo have demonstrated that the new model of financing these events is a rise. I like to think of Kickstarter as the 21st century form of the National Endowment of Arts. Here's a creative thing I want to do. I want the community to fund me, and you're out there in the marketplace competing based on the quality of your work, the quality of your ideas. Right? Artists can seek these grants to finance their creative pursuits. Think back 20, 30, or 40 years to the way we consumed entertainment as young adults. We sat down to watch TV when the shows we liked were on, or we time-shifted using TVs using a VCR. But if you wanted to be a creator, you had to be discovered by a talent scout or an agent. Today, you know, young people can watch what they want when they want. They never know anything different. Would-be entertainers have a potential audience of, well, the whole world through YouTube and other solutions. So the rise of this caring economy that I'm talking about will increase the rewards to humans who care for other humans, right? And we'll do that in collaboration with the computers that we will see. So it's reasonably obvious you start thinking about health. Online health services like the website Cure Together enable users to share data with each other, right? So you help if I'm ill and you're ill and we have the same problem, we can talk about the solutions that we did, similar conditions that connect and provide emotional support. The same thing is sort of a group, but now it's online. There's example after example. We're going to understand more about the human brain and will lead to a growing demand for therapists and psychologists, as well as tools to help monitor moods and well-being. Educators, recent research shows that students do well in a flipped model. I'm on the board of something called the Khan Academy, which is doing this, meaning that they observe lectures online, but then they collaboratively do the homework with other students. Can you imagine that? What a concept. Working with other students, learning together, and learning how to think, and having some fun doing it. And by the way, the demand for teachers in that model goes up, not down. So I'm telling you that the jobs we'll be doing in the future will be more fun, right? They'll enable us to connect with other people more than we do today, and that the creative energy that we use will be so unique to us, will be forever. So I have one final point on job growth and technology. To create these jobs that are rewarding and fun, we need new businesses, right? Recent economic research, and I want to emphasize this to everybody here, has shown that net new jobs, come from new firms. And it turns out that new firms that are showing a very healthy rate of growth as the internet lowers barrier to everything else. It's important to distinguish between new firms and small businesses. There are many, many small businesses, and they're honorable and so forth. They're not growing. Big businesses also don't net grow. They're not the same thing. Conventional wisdom is that these small businesses are the source of this new job creation. But it turns out when you control for firm age, it is the fast-growing new companies, right? So what does that tell you, right? You need to be fast-growing in a new company if you really want to solve the job problem. Net new jobs are not created by small businesses, but by new businesses, and in particular, fast-growing ones. This opportunity, as we're seeing more and more entrepreneurialism and risk-taking than ever, with the internet making it easier and easier and easier. We were talking to one woman who was proud to say that she started her company on $400 using some Google products. Right, does not make a better day for me. The fact of the matter is, think about how inexpensive that is. So if policymakers, and I want to sort of deliver a pretty strong message to policymakers here in the room and in the media, if you want to actually solve this problem, you have to have policies that enable new business creation and entrepreneurship, and then we can, in fact, solve this unemployment problem. Think venture capital-based businesses to the Mac, or venture capital-like businesses. Now, this is hard, of course. It means encouraging disruption, right? So in the American political system, the disruptors are not at the table with the incumbents. The incumbents have all the lobbyists, the laws are written, it gets very difficult to disrupt. But if you can promote risk-taking, politicians can stimulate growth. We're not doing that enough. America has well-positioned to lead here. We're not doing enough. So what are some examples, right? Create some incentives for high-risk investment. Tax capital gains at a lower rate, right? Because capital gains are part of that sort of return. Don't make failure a stigma, right? Many of the most successful entrepreneurs in my world failed once or twice, right? There are countries, Germany is the most obvious example, where business failure can put you in jail. That's a serious disincentive to taking risk, right? Like, as nice as the jails are, don't want to go there, right? You get the idea. So if things like this get in the way, and then figuring out a way to make communities of entrepreneurs share best practices and support each other, right? So welcome global trade, welcome global competition with open firms. So here you are, and you say, Montana's doing great. We won't have any competition. We won't meet with anybody. We're going to ignore the rest of the world. Well, what's going to happen is they're going to run ahead of you, and then you're going to be in trouble because you won't be competitive. You've got to remain globally competitive. In order to do that, you have to avoid the protectionist instincts, which, of course, we all have, and they only reduce risk for your local economy, but they hold you back. And over the long term, you're in big, big trouble. So I want to finish by saying that it's obvious to me that innovation is the only solution to global growth. Right? This has always been true, and it's truer now than ever. Technology will take things that we know as jobs today, right, creating new opportunities for jobs of humans tomorrow. And the only way to succeed is going to be on scaled network platforms, the kind that I'm talking about. There will obviously be creative destruction in the short term, and in that is more businesses are expected in the network, mediocre ones will be rooted out. Well, welcome to capitalism. But the consequence will be more global economic growth and more job creation in the long term. We know that the world will respond to this interconnectedness that I'm talking about by building stronger network cities, right? And that people who don't do this will have to specialize further to remain relevant. What I would like to be able to say to you is that I believe that it's the same truth for joblessness, that the majority of job creation will be within these networks, these trading networks, the platforms that you all are trying to build, and that the impact of technology on all of this is net positive. I can't prove that yet. To finish, let me just say that you're at the beginning of a real opportunity to drive the state forward. You've done a great job getting through the last 5 years. You have all the right seeds, if you will. You have the right attitude. You're well positioned. And with a few policy changes and a little bit of luck, it's going to be a great decade for Montana. Thank you so much. Thank you.